Welcome to the Conference for Women Teleclass, Why Your Fluctuating Moods Are a Strength, Not a Weakness. Our guest today is Julie Holland, MD, a psychopharmacologist and author. Dr. Holland's most recent book is titled Moody Bitches, The Truth About the Drugs You're Taking, The Sleep You're Missing, The Sex You're Not Having, and What's Really Making You Crazy. Dr. Holland is a fellow of the New York Academy of Medicine and a former assistant clinical professor of psychiatry at the New York University School of Medicine. Dr. Holland runs a private practice in Manhattan and is the medical monitor for two clinical research studies on treating post-traumatic stress disorder. Dr. Julie Holland, welcome to the Conference for Women Teleclass.
Well, thanks for having me. I'm happy to be here.
Good. The first question has just got to be, how did you come up with that subtitle? What were you seeing in your practice that made you realize that so many women were experiencing such similar problems?
Well, in terms of the title, it was really meant to be somewhat of a joke and very tongue-in-cheek. And, if you read the book, you'll see that I have a sense of humor and I use humor throughout the book. So it was really just something to get people's attention. The Moody Bitches part. So it needed a subtitle that really explained. I mean, if the book just said Moody Bitches, can you imagine? Nobody would really know what it was about or what's the matter with this woman? Why is she writing that? So it needed to be sort of a long subtitle to explain what were the real contents of the book. So within the book, I talk about sleep and appetite and what we're eating and how we're living our lives and how much sleep we're getting or not getting and why we're not having sex. And I was trying to give a very informative, concise overview of the contents of the book. I mean, the book casts a pretty wide net, and it is a self-help book, but it's a lot more than a self-help book, and it's trying to explain a lot of what's going on in America today with why so many women are medicated. And I really wanted to talk about what these medicines really do, what they can do, what they can't do. You know, I think people have a lot of expectations when they go on medicine that it's going to solve a lot of their problems. And the truth is that you still, even if you really need medicine, you also need sleep and exercise and whole foods and to de-stress and be out in nature. You know, there's all these things that you can do that can help you feel better in addition to the medicine or instead of the medicines.
Okay. Now, as women, or as girls, I guess, many girls learn that from an early age their moods are a problem and something to be managed and moderated and even stuffed away. But in Moody Bitches, you write that that really shouldn't be the case, that our moods are part of what gives us strength as women. Can you talk about that, please?
Well, there's a couple things. I mean, one is that all the suppressing and repressing we do of our emotions and everything that we learn when we're young about how, you know, it's not okay to be upset, it's not okay to be angry, you have to be nice to people, all of that really exacts a toll. You know, we're spending a lot of energy pushing down emotions, not feeling things, trying not to feel things, trying not to convey how we feel about things. And that really is sort of a basic societal problem. I mean, you know, for centuries, men have been told that, you know, they can't cry and they can't be emotional and you're acting like a girl. But now women are getting that message that it's not okay to be emotional, that as soon as you're emotional, you become irrational or hysterical. And the thing we prize more than everything these days is being very intellectual and rational and not getting emotional. That really exacts a toll psychiatrically and physically. I mean, it can make you physically sick to not be in touch with your emotions and to not express your emotions. And women really are naturally cyclical, and our mood naturally changes over the course of our menstrual cycle. So for those of us who aren't taking oral contraceptives and who are what I like to call free range, if you're a free range woman and you've got naturally normal fluctuating hormone levels, you are going to have changes in your mood just based on those hormones, even if your life is very sort of static there are very few variables. I mean, most of us on any given day, what's going on in our lives is going to affect us emotionally. But our hormonal fluctuations are really going to affect how we respond to what's going on in our lives. And we are naturally at a low ebb before our periods. We naturally have less estrogen, less serotonin, sort of flowing through our brains during that period of time, and we are naturally more sensitive. It's easier to cry. It's easier to be sort of irritated or irritable. We may not sleep as well. We may eat more food or crave more carbs around PMS. And all of that is sort of normal and natural. And the flip side of that is that when we are fertile and sort of alluring mid-cycle, our estrogen levels are higher. And because serotonin and estrogen are yoked to some degree, our serotonin levels are also higher mid-cycle. So we are less obsessive, less angsty, more sort of easy breezy, whatever, that's good, okay, I'll take care of it, don't worry. You know, we're more accommodating because of the estrogen. I mean, it's natural to have fluctuations in how resilient we are and how stressed out we are. And what I don't want is for women to medicate away what is really a natural cyclical variation in how they're feeling.
How do you recommend for women who are free-ranging, as you describe it, how do you recommend that they adapt their behavior and the things they need to accomplish to accommodate and account for the hormonal fluctuations that are normal for a woman's cycle?
Well, I think the first thing is sort of, you know, knowledge is power and forewarned is forearmed. So the very first thing that I recommend everyone do is to take notes and start to get a sense of how they feel at different parts in their cycle. See when your PMS happens. Is it just a day or two before your period? Is it a whole week before your period? Notice how you feel when you are mid-cycle and fertile and ovulating. What is your mood like then? Just to get sort of a normal baseline of what the variations are. And also so you can really be prepared for them and you can sort of schedule things accordingly. Like when you are in that PMS low phase, not a good time to go in and ask your boss for a raise. It's not a good time to get waxed or get your teeth drilled into because you've got a lower pain threshold. It is a good time to take on projects that require you to be obsessive because you are going to be sort of more obsessive oriented in those few days before your period. So that's a good time to clean out your closet or tackle a project that requires a lot of attention to details. The first half of the cycle when the estrogen is building and you're becoming fertile, you are sort of more resilient and easier to get along with and sometimes even more physically attractive. So that's a good time to be setting up blind dates. It's a good time to be asking your boss for a raise. It's a good time to go in if you have some sort of evaluation that your boss is going to give you because you will be more resilient and less sensitive and it won't upset you so much. So if you start to have a sense of your cycles, you can really time things to benefit you. And you don't necessarily have to medicate away those fluctuations. But all that being said, there are certainly women who need antidepressants. And, you know, if you have a low mood more days than not for 2 weeks, where every single day you feel terrible and don't want to get out of bed and can't do anything for solid 2 weeks, then you need to see a psychiatrist and you may need to take medicine. But for many of us, we're really just low for a handful of days every month. And you don't necessarily need to take a pill every day to make a space for that kind of emotionality.
Okay, we should let our listeners know that you're in Manhattan and sirens are part of the
just
Manhattan
ignore the
soundscape.
Sirens.
Okay.
Yeah, there's nothing bad going on here. But yes, Third Avenue is right outside my window and there are our car alarms and sirens consistently.
Got it. Now, this subject of medication is really tricky. You write a lot about it in Moody Bitches and about a pharmacological industry that encourages women to medicate away their emotions with psychiatric drugs.
Right.
As a physician, you prescribe those medicines to your own patients, and I'm sure, as you said, that these medications at times are necessary and beneficial. Where do your concerns come in? When are the meds a problem,
right,
and when are they a benefit?
So very complicated question to answer, but you know, a few guidelines. Like I said, first of all, if to meet criteria to have a depression and need antidepressants on a daily basis, you have to have a depressed mood for at least 2 weeks. So that's really something to keep in mind. But psychiatry is very gray. You know, there's ash gray, there's charcoal gray. On any given day, somebody could look like they would really benefit from antidepressants. And the thing to keep in mind is that the medicines are not a test for the diagnosis. Anybody who takes antidepressants is going to feel less anxious and less sad. So they work on everybody. They don't only work on people who have a chemical, a quote chemical imbalance. That's something to keep in mind. Same thing with the ADHD meds, the stimulants that are used for attention deficit disorder. They work on everyone. They are not a diagnosis, you know, if you respond, if you find that you can focus better and read longer when you take an ADD medicine, that doesn't mean you have ADD. It means that you're responding to a stimulant the way that pretty much anybody would. So same thing with the antidepressants. The thing I talk about in Moody Bitches quite a bit is that Big Pharma has been targeting women. They know that women are uncomfortable with being emotional. They know that society pressures us to not cry and not be sad and not be anxious, and they play into those fears, and they target women specifically. They advertise in women's magazines. They advertise on daytime television talk shows, and they're very sort of generic, and, you know, millions of women could be helped by this medicine, you know, if you're anxious or if you worry. And women are really buying into it. I mean, one out of four women in America right now is on some sort of psychiatric medication. And not all these women need to be medicated. And the thing that's really concerning now is that doctors are starting to use antipsychotics to treat depression and to treat anxiety and to treat insomnia. And these medicines have a lot more side effects and a lot more dangers and risks to them than antidepressants do. And antidepressants are no picnic either. I mean, there are serious, significant side effects. The big thing is libido. Women who take antidepressants, especially the class of antidepressants that increases serotonin, there is a decreased libido. There's a decreased desire for sex. There's also a decreased sexual responsiveness or decreased sort of sexual pleasure that comes from these medicines. And also, something I write about in Moody Bitches is that these antidepressants actually affect mating behavior. They affect how aggressively a woman will seek out a partner or not. So it's not just that you're less horny and less interested in sex, you're less interested in connecting and finding a mate.
Wow.
And sometimes being single is part of what's making my patients miserable. So there's a real kind of catch-22 where somebody is anxious or depressed and they go on meds and they feel better, but they're still going to be alone because the medicines have sort of taken away their drive to connect with other people.
You
so there's actually like a marching band going on outside my window right now, which I can't for the life of me explain why. But I don't know if you can
hear it.
Must
be a parade of some sort.
It's crazy.
Well, you mentioned antipsychotics. What are some of the trade names that our listeners would recognize?
Well, the big moneymaker right now for antipsychotics is a medicine called Abilify. It's a very expensive medicine. It actually just went generic about a year, maybe even 2 years ago, but it's still a huge moneymaker. Abilify was FDA approved to treat depression, to be used as an add-on medicine if an antidepressant isn't working. So in as little as 6 weeks, the ads will say if your antidepressant isn't working after 6 weeks, you should try adding this medicine on. But 6 weeks really isn't always enough time for the medicine to work. And sometimes the medicine doesn't work because that's not really the root problem. The problem is that the person isn't getting good sleep, they aren't eating good food, they aren't exercising, just all the sort of basic self-care things that, you know, everybody talks about but we don't actually do. I mean, I really, in Moody Bitches, I try to spell out specifically exactly what you can do to feel better, things that aren't medications. There's all these other things that you can do to feel better that aren't medications, or even if you're taking medications, this is something that you can do in addition to help make the medicines work better.
Got it.
And some of my patients really only need to take antidepressants 2 or 3 days out of the month before their period, because it turns out the rest of the month they're really feeling okay. So you don't necessarily need a daily dose. If you've got targeted, if you have very, very bad PMS, you could just take antidepressants for 2 or 3 days out of the month instead of all month long. And there are real advantages to that in terms of side effects.
Don't some of those medications require maintaining a certain level in the bloodstream?
If you have a major depressive episode, you need to take medicines every day. But you definitely can just take SSRIs for 4 days out of the month or 3 days out of the month. And it will really help PMS. And I have a number of my patients who do that. They don't take medicines every day. They just take it when they have PMS. And now the makers of these medicines won't cop to this. They want you to take a daily dose for years and years. And this is another big issue. People get on these meds and then they stay on the meds because they're very hard to get off of. As soon as you miss a day or 2 days, you start having acute withdrawal symptoms, and people get convinced, like, oh, I must really have a depression because when I stop my medicines, I feel terrible. But the truth is, it's not a diagnostic test. If you have withdrawal symptoms, that's just normal. If you take antidepressants every single day and then you miss a day or two, you are going to have significant withdrawal symptoms. That doesn't mean that you still need to take the medicine. It means that you need to do a gradual taper off the medicine under the guidance of a psychiatrist to make sure that you really still need it. These medicines were not studied or researched or designed to be taken for decades on end, but that is what is happening. People get on the meds and they stay on the meds. And so we have higher numbers of American women who are on these medications who aren't getting off of them.
Now, a huge number of women are self-medicating, and they do that with food, alcohol, and you write about other addictive behaviors, including obsessive screen time.
Right.
Why do women do this, and what can they do to curb those behaviors?
Well, first of all, I think we're all doing it. I mean, in New York City, you walk down the street, everybody is on their phone. They're texting, they're emailing, they're tweeting, they're looking at Facebook. I mean, everybody is sort of very glued into their phones in a compulsive, addictive way. So I think that we're all sort of in denial about how addictive the screen time is. And a lot of us like won't even go to the bathroom now without our phones because you start checking email or looking at Facebook, whatever, in the bathroom. It's happened very quickly that we've gotten super attached to our phones. And I know they're starting to create psychiatric diagnoses for these things, like that feeling of panic that comes over you when you think you don't have your phone with you.
Mm-hmm.
What is that about? I mean, that seems like very kind of compulsive and addictive to me. So that is one way that we soothe ourselves. I mean, what I talk about in Moody Bitches is this idea that people want to sort of escape from the now, from the present. They want to be somewhere else. They want to go to elsewhere. And you can watch a TV show and sort of escape from your present life, or you can get online and escape, or you could go to a bar and get drunk and you escape from your life, or you could get stoned, or you could use other drugs. I mean, there's all sorts of things that people do that are sort of self-soothing behaviors. That can become compulsions or addictions. And the first step in breaking that is to sort of embrace this mindfulness where you are present, where you are in your body, where you're not trying to escape every 5 minutes, where you just sort of learn to stay and be in your body and to feel your feelings. I gave a talk at one of your conferences, and I talked about people feeling their feelings, and I used a swear word to describe the situation. I was like, feel your feelings, because it's sort of rule number one, that we're so taught to disregard how we're feeling or push it down or not give a voice to it or not get upset, don't cry. And really what we need to do is stay present and be in our bodies and not be sort of detached and elsewhere, and to really feel our feelings. And that is the first step to feeling better, is to really allow the feelings to be and to give them a voice.
You dedicate an entire chapter to something I think a lot of women can relate to, and that is the direct link between food and mood. And I wondered if you could talk about this connection that's harming so many women, along with some practical advice for correcting or repairing that relationship.
Right. Well, one of the things that I talk about in the food chapter quite a bit is this idea of being present and being in your body and sort of calming yourself down when it's time to eat. I think a lot of us sort of check out when we start eating, and it's very easy to get into this sort of binge place where you're not really paying attention, you're not fully present, you're in this sort of like a fugue state, like a dissociative state. So one of the take-home messages from the food chapter is how to eat, and that really comes down to sort of mindfulness tips. But then a lot of the chapter is talking about what to eat. And the simple kind of bottom line take-home message is that you should be following an anti-inflammatory diet, that there's tons of research making a very strong connection between inflammation and depression, inflammation and anxiety, inflammation and insomnia, inflammation and irritability. So anything you can do to decrease inflammation is going to help your mood. So an anti-inflammatory diet is an important part of this sort of whole anti-inflammatory regimen, which also includes things like exercise and mindfulness and stress reduction. And the other thing I talk about in Moody Bitches quite a bit, actually, is is cannabis and the body's sort of natural cannabis-based system. There's something called an endocannabinoid system. Even if you've never smoked a joint in your life, you have cannabis-like molecules that go all through your body from head to toe. And there's receptors in the brain, all over the brain, for cannabis-like molecules. But there's also receptors in the pancreas, in the stomach, and in the bladder, and in the bones, and in the muscle. It really is a body-wide system that helps to keep you sort of in balance and in some sort of homeostasis. So cannabis is this ancient medicinal plant, which is really a potent anti-inflammatory medicine. So there may be a place for cannabis in this sort of global anti-inflammatory regimen, if you want to take that on. But the body's endocannabinoid system is very much involved with eating and continuing eating and stopping eating. So, you know, the thing I talk about with the munchies, for instance, pot doesn't necessarily make you seek out food. It makes you keep eating. So the trick to avoid the munchies is just don't have any food anywhere near you. Don't start. If you just keep your mouth closed, you will not have any problem. But as soon as you start eating, it's going to be very hard to stop. And that's kind of what happens with a binge, too, even if you're not stoned, is that your body's endocannabinoid system, once you start eating, wants you to keep eating. So it may be that, you know, medicine to target the endocannabinoid system can help regulate metabolism and regulate appetite. And there's plenty of medical research going on right now to look into that and to sort of take advantage of the endocannabinoid system as a target for medication development.
Now, a lot of discussion around emotional and mental health deals with the stigma surrounding mental illness and the need for treatment. And I just want to ask you if you could talk a little bit more about when psychiatric care and possible medication is called for, and when a woman can look to some of the other remedies that you talk about in the book, some of the natural therapies, such as exercise, better sleep management, change in diet. How does a woman know where she is on the spectrum, when to get help, and what kind of help to get?
Well, I mean, optimally, a woman is not making these decisions on her own. She is making them with a psychiatrist or with an internist, like a GP, who really has time to sit and work through everything with you. I mean, the problem is right now that 80% of prescriptions are being written by people who aren't psychiatrists. They're being written by internists or GPs or family medicine doctors who are spending like 10 minutes with somebody. And it's not enough time to really tease apart, do you have a psychiatric history? Does your family have a psychiatric history? Because diagnoses run in families and treatment response runs in families. Like if two or three members in your family are taking the same medicine, that's certainly the one that you should start with because it may work for you if it's working for them. But figuring out whether you have a bona fide psychiatric diagnosis or whether you're just unhealthy in the way that you're living your life, and that if you make changes in your diet and sleep, you might feel better. I mean, there's two ways to go about that. One way is that you start with a doctor and the psychiatrist and get a diagnosis and take it from there. The other way is that you make all the changes. You sleep better, you eat better, you exercise more, you get outside, you get in nature, you make sure you're getting enough sunshine, you do all these things, and if you're still feeling terrible, then yes, you may need medication. I don't think many people do it that way. I think people kind of, you know, go to the doctor. And if you go to the doctor and you say, you know, I'm stressed out, I'm not feeling well, I'm not sleeping well, you're going to leave with a prescription. I can pretty much guarantee you, you're going to walk out of that office with a prescription. That prescription doesn't mean you have a psychiatric diagnosis. It means take this pill, you're going to feel better, and I don't want to talk to you for an hour about what you had for breakfast and, you know, whether you're getting outside and getting any sunshine. So I think we need like a basic overhaul of how we treat people in America, because there's a very high incidence of leaving the doctor's office with a prescription in your hand when that's not necessarily what's really best for you. But it is certainly what is quickest and what is easiest for everybody involved. It's easier for the doctor. It's easier for the patient. You know, there are sometimes where you don't feel like you even saw the doctor if you leave without a prescription. You know, we've gotten into this habit in America. We're so used to being medicated for anything. We're so comfortable taking a pill. And it's harder to change your diet and make sure you get enough sleep and get off your computer at 9 or 10 o'clock at night so that you're not totally wired you know, from that light. It's hard to make those changes. It's easier to just take a pill and keep, you know, eating crappy food and not getting enough sleep.
That 80% figure is really a stunning statistic.
Yeah, well, the 1 out of 4 women in America taking a psychiatric medication kind of scares me, and the 80% figure also scares me. But the thing to keep in mind is that in certain demographics, it's higher than 1 out of 4. And if you add in sleeping pills, it's way higher than 1 out of 4. There's
mm-hmm.
more and more women taking sleeping pills. And there are interesting studies showing that chronically taking sleeping pills, you know, may take years off your life. So you know, we pretend that these are totally benign medicines that don't have any sort of repercussions or ramifications. And they've got physiological side effects, and they've got psychological side effects.
Talk about the dangers of sleeping pills that you've identified in your practice.
Well, the biggest thing with Ambien is that once it kicks in, you have no recollection of what's going on. Your brain kind of turns to Teflon, and you don't really generate any new memories. So if you're going to take Ambien, it's really best that you take it when you're already in bed and you don't get out of bed and you don't get on your computer. You're going to buy things that you don't remember. You're going to email people. You have no sense of, like, you know, I had a patient who would wake up in the morning and look at the cell phone and be like, oh, no, who did I call last night? What did I say? Just having no recollection of the content of the conversation. So that's one issue. The other issue is that it can be very disinhibiting, and so people end up eating, sort of binging at night when the medicine kicks in. And, you know, waking up in the morning and discovering sort of pots and pans in the kitchen and having no sense of what got consumed. So those are sort of the immediate issues. But there was a really concerning study. I don't have the reference in front of me, but there's definitely, it's in Moody Bitches and it's in the references. A really large study that looked at an outpatient population in Pennsylvania that showed that the people who were taking sleeping pills had increased mortality, like they were dying earlier.
And do we know why?
No, we don't. And the big question you should ask yourself is, who is going to fund that study?
Mm-hmm.
Because if you think the makers of Ambien are going to fund a study looking at the dangers of Ambien, you're not getting the message here. But, you know, I do have to sort of make one big caveat, which is that there are plenty of women who do need psychiatric medication. There are women who have bipolar disorder. There are women who have schizophrenia. There are women who have major depressive episodes or panic disorder. They need medicine. But that doesn't mean you can't add all these other anti-inflammatory behaviors on top of the medicine to make it work better and allow you to take a lower dose of the medicine. But these are decisions that need to be made by a psychiatrist, not by big pharma, not by an ad you saw, and not by sort of a harried general practitioner who is
mm-hmm.
just going to give you a prescription and send you on your way. I mean, the problem is that there really aren't enough psychiatrists to go around in America.
Mm-hmm. So you offer some practical advice involving sex, exercise, and sleep strategies that will help women whether or not they are in need of medication or whether they are perhaps unnecessarily medicated. It sounds as though your approach is to say this all should be taken under the care of a psychiatrist. Who can look at the overall health and mental health of the patient.
Yeah, if possible, that's certainly the best way to go. I mean, I think it bears sort of getting into the specifics of, like, somebody who just had a baby who may have postpartum depression or even postpartum psychosis. I mean, that person needs to be evaluated very carefully because they really may need medication. I mean, that's a particularly sort of dangerous, vulnerable time in a woman because of the hormones. Again, I mean, there are real connections between hormonal fluctuations and mood. And there's a lot of fluctuations that happen after you deliver a baby. And there's also a lot of fluctuations for years and years in women who are perimenopausal. So, you know, 45 to 55 is this kind of demographic where women are going to have a lot of psychiatric complaints. They're going to have trouble sleeping. They're going to have irritability, and they may have anger issues. It's a very common time to go to see a psychiatrist when you never have seen one before, because the mood swings and the PMS and things like that can get very intense around perimenopause. So I wrote a whole chapter about perimenopausal symptoms and some things that you can do to help with that, particularly kind of erratic time in our sort of hormonal lives, let's say.
Okay. Well, that is all we have time for today. Today's teleclass will be available as a podcast on your conference website. So if you registered through Eventbrite, you'll receive an email telling you when the podcast is available. Our thanks to Dr. Julie Holland and to our listeners. The book is Moody Bitches, The Truth About the Drugs You're Taking, The Sleep You're Missing, The Sex You're Not Having, and What's Really Making You Crazy.